versus Parker. You ready to proceed?
Yes, sir.
Good morning, Justice Holland, Justice Jacobs, Justice Ridgely. I'm Michael Foster. I represent the appellant in this interlocutory appeal. My clients thank you for accepting this on such short notice. I'm joined at counsel table by my colleague, James Maxwell. We're both from the Department of Justice. I'd like to confine my initial short remarks this morning to three areas. Number one, the litigation heartaches that have gone on between my clients and the plaintiffs since 1997. Number two, I'd like to answer the question, why would the state defendants, after litigating for 8 years, waive a statute of limitations defense? Number three, I'd like to answer the question, did they waive the statute of limitations defense? Plaintiff was employed as a nurse at the Ferris School. She was fired in 1996 for allegations of theft. In 1997, she filed her first claim against Delaware, my clients. She filed in the EEOC that her firing was racially based and illicit. In 1998, she filed a claim in front of the Merit Employees Review Board that her firing was racially based and illicit. In 1998, she filed her first lawsuit, which was a Title VII and Section 1983 case in the United States District Court in Wilmington. In 1999, she filed a second lawsuit in the Superior Court in Wilmington, alleging that her firing was a breach of employment contract, a breach of the covenant of fair dealing, defamation, ADA claims. Those claims, the 1999 state suit, may have been filed within the appropriate statute of limitations. The first suit in 1998 was in fact filed within a 2-year statute of limitations applicable.
I was looking through the briefs to find out from either side what they contended the appropriate statute of limitations was, and it doesn't seem to be anywhere in the briefs.
2 years? 2 years. The 1983 statute of limitations, 2 years.
That's uncontested.
I believe the, and I can't speak for the other side, but I believe the other side has argued that their case runs back to 1998.
I understand, but the statute of limitations is or is not disputed to be a 2-year statute.
No, it is not disputed. After, in 1999, the plaintiff sued in Superior Court, as I just said, the state, who was already combating the plaintiff, had combated the plaintiff in MERB, the EEOC, and in the first federal court case, removed the Superior Court case 1 month after it was filed to join it with the federal causes of action, which in fact were based on the same alleged behavior, even though the state cases, we believe, still are tort and contract cases. The federal court in the year 2000 dismissed the first federal case for failure to serve the defendants. The plaintiff's response to that in the year 2000 was to file a second federal claim based on the same causes of action, which the court dismissed in the next year, in the year 2001, for failure to serve the defendants. Delaware was involved heavily in briefing and combating those claims also. At the time the federal court dismissed the second case, the second federal case, it sent back the case which Delaware had removed to the federal court because the court said the court had failed to deal with it in a timely fashion, so sent it back to Superior Court. There was a little bit of paper discovery done between the parties at that point in Superior Court. There were great difficulties dealing with the plaintiff's attorney. I eventually learned that that attorney was having difficulties with her ethical obligations and was being investigated. At about the same time, that attorney filed multiple motions to withdraw from the remaining Superior Court case. Eventually, without my knowledge, that motion was granted. Eventually, I learned that that attorney was censured by this court. I was not part of any of those proceedings or asked about my dealings with that attorney. New counsel entered the case thereafter. Their initial actions were to file a motion for an amended complaint, which state defendants opposed. State defendants said, this is unfair. We beat 1983 cases two times in federal court. You're beyond the statute of limitations. You're adding new parties by making our individual clients personally liable. It's just not a tort case. It's not a contract case. It's unfair. And the statute of limitations is 2 years in 1983 cases. State defendants filed a six-page memoranda on those principles. Plaintiff filed a memoranda. The court, in turn, filed a very large opinion, between 30 and 40 pages, and did not deal with the statute of limitations issue at all, but for a footnote in which it said that apparently the federal court had decided there were no statute of limitations issues. State defendants responded with their first dispositive motion, which was a motion to dismiss, quoting Wilson v. Garcia. State defendants had cited to Wilson v. Garcia in their opposition to the motion to amend two times in that little six-page memorandum. On April 16th, there was an office conference in Superior Court at which the court decided that the state defendants had waived their right to use the statute of limitations because they wasted precious judicial resources by I don't know what.
By not arguing that an amendment would be futile since the statute had expired.
Well,
I mean, that is what the court ruled, wasn't it?
In part, because the court at the same time dismissed the co-defendant who had ignored the motion to amend and then filed the identical statute of limitations motion as the state defendants filed.
The other defendant had not been served at the time. It was the other defendant was differently situated, was it not?
The docket entries from 7 or 8 years ago show that on the same day that Mr. Eichler, who then was a defendant, was served, on the same day Diane Gaddow was served, and that Janet Parker was served by serving Diane Gaddow. There was no judicial determination that that was not effective service.
But the other defendants took the position that service was not effectively accomplished.
They said that at the office conference, yes, Your Honor. The court, however, made no decision thereon. The court said that there's a 2-year statute of limitations here, and the court discussed abatement, the court discussed relation back, and dismissed the abatement issues, the relation back issues, by questioning both me and my brother counsel who represented the co-defendant. At that point, the court said that Dr. Kramer, in effect, you can go. Statute has run, and you're right. You're dismissed. But the state, because they didn't effectively argue this last month, is in the case.
Well, what the court
The court said words to that effect. You characterized it as not effectively arguing it. And the court basically determined that you had alluded to the statute of limitations, but it wasn't the centerpiece of your memorandum. And now it had become the centerpiece of the motion to dismiss, but the court thought if it really was going to be something the court should focus on, you should have made it the centerpiece of your response to the motion to amend. Wasn't that basically what the court said?
Yes, it is basically what the court said. At the time of the motion to amend, if the amendment had been denied, there was a viable, perhaps, lawsuit lurking to which the state had filed an answer, including defense, multiple defenses of statute of limitations. In this matter, there was no scheduling conference, there was no discovery, there was no trial date. This was the first time the Superior Court put pen to pencil in the case after the state defendants had been run hither and yon and litigating for 8 years against this plaintiff.
Your point being that it wasn't the litigants or counsel that were prejudiced, it was the trial judge, and that's not legally sufficient to...
Well,
I mean,
then, no, that's not my argument, Your Honor. My argument is, of course, that there is no prejudice to the plaintiff, especially after all this time. And the principal reason why waiver is imposed is because of prejudice to parties.
Well, why didn't you argue the futility of the amendment based on the statute of limitations?
The plaintiff, in his opening memoranda, had argued that the statute of limitations, in effect, didn't matter because this state case referred back to the timely filed 1998 case, as if this amendment were an amendment to the 1998 case.
And the judge rejected that by dismissing the claim against the co-defendant.
Had to, Your Honor.
We need to look at this matter, which is a procedural matter in a somewhat larger context, thinking about what happens in other cases. I gather you don't challenge the proposition that I believe the court below relied on, that even when raised in the answer, the limitations defense has to be raised at the earliest practicable opportunity. Correct?
I agree with that principle, yes.
Okay. And the issue is whether that earliest practicable opportunity was in your opposition to the motion to amend. If you're right, that is, if your side is right in its position, then even if the statute of limitations would establish perfectly that an amendment would be futile, your position is that it isn't necessary to raise that argument because it can always be raised as a substantive motion to dismiss, assuming that amendment is allowed.
No, I don't believe it can always be raised. I think there are matters in which, perhaps in this suit, if the motion in opposition went as it did, and if the state then didn't file a dispositive motion, and then if the state did file an answer, including the defense, but then if the state did not file a summary judgment motion.
I'm not sure what you're saying. I'm trying to glean from your position if there's a rule of law lurking somewhere. And you seem to be saying that, well, in some cases, the defendant has an option to whether or not to raise a statute of limitations defense in opposition to a motion to amend, and other times it doesn't.
Well, it is fact dependent.
Well, what is the bright line?
Well, as I started to say, if the state did nothing, including not filing a dispositive motion or a motion for summary judgment, and yet had used statute of limitations as a defense in their answer, which was not done at that time, because there was no scheduling, there were no dispositive motions done yet. And then if the state on the eve of trial had said, Your Honor, I'd like to have my my statute of limitations defense heard. The court on the eve of trial might rightly say, now wait a minute, you've been in depositions for 9 months, you didn't file a motion to dismiss, you didn't do this, you didn't do that, so you can't raise that at any time, especially on the night before trial. This was not the night before trial.
Mr. Tucker, I wanted to reserve 5 minutes, and you can continue now, but I wanted you to know that you're into your rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. I will reserve.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning, Justice Holland, Justice Jacobs, Justice Ridgely. My name is John LaRosa, and I represent, along with my co-counsel, Thomas Neuberger, the appellee and plaintiff below, Mrs. Joyce Parker. May it please the court. This is an action under 42 U.S.C. Sections 1983 and 1981 for race discrimination in the terms, conditions, and eventual termination of employment of Joyce Parker, an African-American nurse employed by the state of Delaware for over 21 years. Her incompetent and eventually disbarred prior counsel, Carolyn Ayers, withdrew from the case, and Ms. Parker conducted an extensive and diligent search for new counsel. In early 2003, Attorney Neuberger and I entered our appearances and moved to amend the complaint to dismiss numerous claims of sex and disability discrimination and common law claims, and to narrow and focus the issues in a very fact-specific pleading focused solely on race discrimination under Sections 1983 and 1981. After extensive briefing by both sides, the Superior Court granted leave for Joyce Parker to amend the original complaint in a lengthy October 14, 2003 opinion. And after the appellants were defeated on the issue of amendment of the complaint, defendants Diane Goodell and the Delaware Department of Health and Social Services moved to dismiss on limitations grounds.
Mr. Wilson, Justice Jacobs is asking Mr. Foster about the rule of law we glean from this. So, with your recitation of the facts, let me follow up on that question, because I'm a little confused. It seems to me the Superior Court had before it a motion to amend the complaint, and that you could oppose the motion to amend the complaint if you were the state for any reason, but that was the real issue. Should the complaint be amended or not? Then the motion was granted, so the complaint was amended. Then the state wanted to raise the affirmative defense of statute of limitations, and the Superior Court said you're too late. It appears that if this is going to be the rule of law, that notwithstanding Rule 8 of the Superior Court rules and Rule 15, it says you can file affirmative defenses in response to a pleading, and there wasn't a pleading until the amended complaint was permitted, but what the Superior Court has said is if you have affirmative defenses and you don't raise them in opposition to a motion to amend, you've raised them. How would anyone realize that you needed to raise all affirmative defenses in response to a motion to amend a complaint or else they would be deemed to be waived?
I think the appellant should have realized it when they saw our motion to amend with the exhibit that showed we wished to amend the complaint to focus it on the Section 1983 and Section 1981 case.
But isn't the effect of the Superior Court holding to say, notwithstanding what is written in Rule 8 and Rule 15 about raising affirmative defenses in response to a pleading, if an amended complaint is permitted and you haven't previously raised those affirmative defenses, you can't raise them because they're waived? It really changes the way Rule 8 and Rule 15 operate, doesn't it?
I think that's not quite what the court was saying. I think what the court was saying is in analysis of a motion to amend, where one of the factors is futility of amendment, if you do not argue that amendment is futile because a statute of limitations defense would apply to the complaint as the movements wish to amend the complaint.
What does futility mean in this context? Does this mean that the defendants would ultimately prevail? Should they be filing affidavits and essentially a summary judgment type of response to the motion to amend?
No, Justice Ridge, I don't think they would have to go that far. I think they would have to argue in their response to our motion to amend that amendment is futile because we have a limitations to the defense to the claims that plaintiff now wishes to raise in her proposed amended complaint.
But you see, in your answer, you've just picked one affirmative defense, statute of limitations. And it appears that the Superior Court said, if you have a position that's dispositive with regard to this amended complaint, you better tell me before I permit the amendment, because I'm not going to let you put it in your answer, and I'm not going to let you put it in a motion once I grant it. I want to know it now. So we really move the debate on affirmative defenses that are dispositive to the motion to amend, rather than a motion to dismiss one answer.
Well, I think it had already been raised in the original answer to the original complaint. So in that sense, the appellants, the defendants below were aware of the defense, had introduced the defense in their answer to the original complaint, and now is the time for them to more fully expound on this boilerplate defense that they listed in the original answer.
Well, our court has cases, I'm sure you're familiar with, that hold if you don't raise an issue fully and fairly in your opening brief, you waive it. You can't put it in a reply brief, and it's not fully and fairly raised if it's in a footnote. You know the cases. By analogy, in this case, was the Superior Court basically saying, even though the state cited Wilson versus Garcia and talked about the statute of limitations being a problem, that it did not fully and fairly present that argument?
Yes, that's how I saw the case. Judge Jordan talked in terms of waiver of the statute of limitations, but I think what was really going on was Judge Jordan was aware of a limitations defense due to the fact that it had been in the defendant's below and their original answer. It had been mentioned and argued in anticipation of a counter-argument by myself in our legal memorandum in support of the motion to amend, and it was before the court, as is noted by the fact that in footnote 12 of Judge Jordan's original opinion, she mentions the statute of limitations. So it was in her mind, and it had been raised, if not effectively argued by the appellant. That's how.
Then how was it raised? I mean, your answer seems to suggest that it was raised, and Judge Jordan ruled against them on the merits in the footnote. So if that's what she said, then this motion to dismiss would basically be re-argument. You could have come back and said, res judicata, it's in the footnote, I amended the complaint. But it's hard for me to translate citing a statute of limitations case in your memo, having it addressed in the opinion, albeit in a footnote, equaling a waiver. It seems the issue was joined and it was ruled on by the court, and in the state's motion to dismiss, it wanted to pursue it further.
I think it can be viewed as either way, either as a waiver by the appellant by not arguing it effectively, or as having raised it and just not arguing it effectively, and Judge Jordan implicitly ruling on it by granting the motion to amend and finding that amendment would not be futile.
Are all the other affirmative defenses in the answer waived as a result of the Rule 15 motion hearing?
I believe that any affirmative defenses that should have been mentioned in the analysis of the motion to amend the complaint are waived at that point, because that was the time for, rather than have the court go into a lengthy 40-page opinion on the issue of amendment of the complaint, that was the time for the appellants, the defendants below, to raise and fully argue those issues, to say to the lower court, look, Your Honor, this motion to amend should not be granted because we have affirmative defenses, including the statute of limitations and whatever other applicable affirmative defenses they felt were meritorious defenses at that point.
Well, it would have been a prudential thing to do, that is to raise squarely the limitations defense in the context of a motion to amend. But the question before us is whether there was any procedure. do that. And if there is, then there must be some source for it. It's certainly not in the procedural rules. Is there a case?
I think the case is the case that Judge Jordan relied on, Robinson v. Johnson, which
and that's the case that holds you need to do it at the earliest available time. And that's the question the three of us have been asking you. You seem to be saying somewhere you can translate earliest available time to be in response to the motion to amend, notwithstanding the fact that it looks like you could file a motion to dismiss or an answer with affirmative defenses.
I think as far as asking you to translate, I'm just asking you to uphold the finding of the lower court, which said that this was the earliest practicable moment to raise
If you're correct, then our holding will basically be whenever you're presented with a motion to amend the complaint, your response has to be the functional equivalent of an answer to the complaint, including all affirmative defenses.
Or at least all affirmative defenses that are implicated by the motion to amend.
I'm not sure that the responding party would have to go that far. I think the responding party would have to engage in the analysis of the factors necessary for amendment to the complaint, one being futility, and under that factor, any reason why amendment would be futile, and in this situation, I think that amendment would be futile because of they should have raised that argument under their futility analysis.
I think we understand your position on that point. Help us understand why, if the state cites Wilson v. Garcia for the proposition the statute of limitations is a bar, and the court writes an opinion in a footnote that says, looks like the federal court didn't find the statute of limitations to be a problem, that issue hasn't been joined, at least initially, as opposed to being waived.
It hasn't been joined because it was not argued effectively by appellants, and the statute of limitations should relate back to the original statute of limitations for Section 1983.
Mr. LaRosa, while you're still standing up there, I need to take you into a different area because it may be relevant. The Supreme Court of the United States last spring handed down a decision, the name of which unfortunately eludes me. I apologize for that. But the holding of the case was that if a claim arises under a 1991 amendment to Section 1981, then the statute of limitations is 4 years. I don't know whether, considering circulating that case to counsel, but after I looked through your brief, I saw no reference to Section 1981. Nor did I hear any until you stood up today. What is the 1991 claim? Does it arise under the 1991 amendment?
Under the Section 1981 claims are race discrimination in contracts in terms of the terms and conditions of Ms. Parker's employment and also in the termination of her employment that there was race discrimination in a contractual relationship being the...
Are you familiar with the 1991 amendment to Section 1981?
I'm familiar with the amendment to increase the statute of limitations to 4 years.
Well, can you help us then? Let's assume that the state had said that the amendment is futile because of the statute of limitations. What is your concise argument that it... Is it futile, or do you concede that, or are you saying that it is not futile, and why?
If the state had argued that amendment was futile because of the limitations, then I think there is a strong possibility that the Section 1980... I think that we would still argue that the claims relate back to the original federal action, which was timely filed within the two-year statute of limitations under the relation back doctrine, because all the conduct, transactions, and occurrences from this case deal with the conditions of Ms. Parker's employment for the state of Delaware and the fact that African Americans were treated differently than Caucasians at her place of employment. So that, as Mr. Foster says, we've dealt with Section 1983 two times. Well, actually, Section 1983, the two federal cases, neither one was decided on the merits. And Ms. Parker has not had an opportunity to have her case heard on the merits.
And that's an argument under Rule 15 as opposed to the savings statute.
Yes, I believe so. Finally, the equities of the case weigh in favor of our client. Ms. Parker is an African-American state employee nurse who was employed by the state of Delaware for over 21 years.
Is this related to the statute of limitations? And the reason I ask that, are you suggesting that if the statute of limitations is otherwise a bar, there's an exception based on equities? Because this court has said the statute of limitations is harsh, and we've seen a lot of what appear to be meritorious claims that were just time-barred. So are you arguing that equities are an exception to the time bar?
No, I'm not trying to argue an exception. I'm saying as background, the equities weigh in favor of my client, but I'm not conceding that the statute of limitations is a bar in this case.
Well, if you're not arguing that the equities create some exception to the statute, then what's the relevance of arguing the equities?
Because as Judge Jordan mentioned in her opinion, there is a policy of favoring litigation on the merits, and this is a case that, despite its long procedural history, has not been heard on the merits. The appellants have had notice of a Section 1983 claim since the 1998 original federal action, so they have been on notice of a Section 1983 claim. But
how does that affect at all the limitations analysis?
If you're looking at the limitations analysis in purely the legal sense, then I'm not sure if it does play into that analysis.
And don't we have to look at the statute in a purely legal sense?
Yes, the statute of limitations should be looked at in that sense. And also, there's no prejudice to the appellant. If the motion to dismiss is denied because the lower court was unpersuaded by the appellant's assertions that they are now prejudiced because they were unaware that Section 1983 liability might attach, the appellants were aware of their exposure to Section 1983 liability.
But the motion to dismiss wasn't denied on the merits. The motion to dismiss was denied on the basis that the argument presented had been waived. Is that correct?
Yes, that the appellants had waived that argument by not raising it in their response to our motion to amend.
What about the issue of suddenly there's individual liability as opposed to being sued in the official capacities?
The individual defendant is Diane Goodall, and she has been exposed to individual liability from the outset of the litigation going back to the original federal complaint in 1998. So our position is that there is no new exposure to individual liability for the individual defendant, Ms. Goodall.
And we only have about a minute and a half. But tell the court why it was logically consistent for the Superior Court to dismiss the other defendants and leave the state defendants in the case.
It was logically consistent because, as Justice Jacobs pointed out, the other individual defendant was not similarly situated to Ms. Goodall. She contended that she had not been properly served with the original complaint in this state action, and also she had not participated in any of the litigation, most importantly, the motion to amend. The individual defendant Diane Goodall and the State of Delaware Department of Health and Social Services had participated in the litigation. They had responded to the motion to amend, and they did not effectively argue the statute of limitations at that point, and that's why they had waived the statute of limitation.
You objected to that dismissal, though, right?
Yes.
And still do?
We did not appeal that dismissal.
It may not be part of this, but ultimately it's still your position that she should be a party.
If the court's reasoning included the fact that she had not been properly served by our prior counsel, then I think that any argument on our behalf to try and keep her in the case would be futile at that point. So in that sense, I do not disagree with the court's ruling. Right.
Thank you very much, Mr. Reversa. Mr. Tappan, you have about 4.5 minutes.
And, Your Honor, I actually have no further argument, but I'll certainly entertain any questions.
Why doesn't this relate back under Rule 15?
The relation back under Rule 15 would relate back to the filing of this case, which was in 1999. Relation back doesn't say, and by the way, if you had another case somewhere else called something else, just as long as it depends upon the same type of facts, then we'll relate back to that case, wherever it is, whenever it was filed.
Well, aren't the actions essentially identical?
No, the actions are not essentially identical. The factual allegations of the plaintiff are all race-based. But no, interference with contract is not a 1983 claim. Defamation is not a 1983 claim. The other state torts and state contract claims are not civil rights actions.
What's your understanding of the status of the plaintiff's 1981 claim?
Your Honor is using 1991 as opposed to 1983?
Section 1981 as opposed to Section 1983.
In what way?
Is there such a claim in the case?
Not that I'm aware of.
The other side argues that there is such a claim in the case.
The new claim, is a race-based claim that everything the state of Delaware did against the plaintiff is in violation of 1983. And that's how I read it.
And 1981, because it isn't mentioned, is therefore not part of the case.
I can't recall, Your Honor, if 1991 is written.
1981.
I cannot recall if that is written down on the complaint right now. Sorry, I can't answer.
Are you saying as a matter of law that there cannot be a relation back in a state court action, that there can be no relation back to a comparable federal court action?
No, I'm not saying that.
I'll let you answer.
I'm saying they're not comparable. And the reason they're not comparable is because the original federal claim was a 1983 claim. The second federal claim was a 1983 claim. And the intervening state claim was a tort action and a contract action.
But aren't those labels? I mean, if the facts, the core facts that give rise to all of these causes of action are the same, isn't that dispositive for relation back purposes?
I don't believe so, because the statute of limitations had run for a 1983 claim by 1999. So defendants believe that plaintiff sued in state court to get hold of another cause of action based on tort and contract. Because
isn't it true that if you prevail in this appeal and your motion to dismiss is considered on the merits so that there has to be a response, then whether or not there's a relation back will be something for the Superior Court to address in the first instance. Where we are right now is simply that the court has ruled your motion is denied because you waived it.
Respectfully, Your Honor, I believe that the court below on April 16th ruled that relation back did not apply in this case because of the discussion in that office conference, which is in the transcription, which ultimately led to the dismissal as a matter of law to the co-defendant.
Well, I understand. And that would be something that you would bring up. But at least today, when we're listening to the arguments, we're still hearing there's this, you're saying the statute of limitation is viable. Your opponents are saying Relation Back is viable. And that's something that maybe you can all renew in the Superior Court.
I disagree respectfully because I believe that the law of the case is that Relation Back does not apply, and I believe that was decided on April 16th.
I understand that, but that's something you'll address if it's renewed by your opponent. You think it's been decided?
Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Rosa and Mr. Tepper, thank you very much for your arguments. The court will take this matter under advisement and also take a brief recess.